This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from some undisclosed location in Israel, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And where are you, Brent?
I'm in Eilat, so on the shores of the Red Sea.
Okay. And you're doing a report there on what Iran has been up to lately.
Yeah, on Sunday I plan to record a segment about Iran's activities and Israel's in the Red Sea over the past couple of weeks.
Well, for our first story today, basically we want to give you the opportunity to give us a preview of what you're going to be talking about on Watch Jerusalem this weekend.
Yeah, so there was a lot of reporting this week about an attack that Israel made in the Red Sea against an Iranian vessel. And this was leaked by the United States to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal immediately after it happened. Israel, on Tuesday morning at 7:30 local time, struck the Saviz, which is an Iranian ship, Iranian flagship, kind of like a, it's not really a container ship, but it is a kind of like a cargo vessel that's been sitting inside the Red Sea for the last couple of years, just off the coast of Yemen. And it turns out that the Saviz has been used as a forward projecting base for the Iranians inside the middle of the Red Sea, just north of the Bab el-Mandab Strait, one of these choke points that we talk about so often. And there's been there's shots of this this vessel with guns on it, commandos on it. Basically, the IRGC uses this to destabilize traffic, maritime traffic through that choke point, as well as support the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And so Israel did indeed attack that vessel at 7:30 in the morning on Tuesday, and immediately told the Americans that they were going to do so. And what was surprising is how quick it made it to the press, I believe. The New York Times straight away had a story saying that Israel attacked an Iranian vessel. It talked about the fact that the Saviz is probably not a civilian vessel, but actually a military vessel. But what's interesting about this, I would say, are two things. One, that you have an Iranian military vessel that is watching over maritime traffic through one of the most important passageways in the world, acting as that gatekeeper, not just from the coast of Yemen through the Houthis that we've reported about, but actually with its own, one of its fleet right there doing that, and the fact that Israel would be bold enough to attack it. But just how quickly the Americans, the Biden administration, the intelligence agencies would go to the press to report on it, something that they received from Israel covertly. This is something that Israel does not normally discuss. They conduct such clandestine attacks and have done so for the past 2 years. But it's only the Americans that are leaking this, leaking these stories to the press.
Maybe you could just explain why Israel would be discussing this with the United States, given the fact that they're dealing with an administration that is much more hostile to Israeli interests than the previous administration.
Well, I think they really just don't have much choice. I don't think they're asking for permission. This was something that they were going to do anyway. And it did come on the same day that you had the nuclear negotiations with Iran start back up between the United States and Iran in Vienna. And so it was seen as a way that Israel is trying to show the United States that you might be dealing peaceably with the Iranians and trying to empower the Iranians through the nuclear deal, but we are going to act, if we have to, separate from the United States. Now, it's also true that the United States aircraft carrier, the Nimitz, was traveling through the region, and it might have been that Israel notified the United States that they were going to do this attack because of the American aircraft carrier that was near it. Now, what's also interesting about this is that it was a limpet mine that Israel used to attack the side of this vessel. No, it didn't sink it, but it certainly was a warning shot from Israel that they are able to do this. This wasn't an aircraft. This wasn't a drone. This was a mine that was planted by Israelis at the right off the coast of Yemen, right where Iran is. Now, we know that Israel has submarines that it's transited the Suez Canal over the past couple of months. And so there is a very interesting war going on, shadow war, they're calling it, in the background. And really, Israel sees that it has to act alone in this, except we know that the Saudis would be supporting Israeli action as well as Egypt at this time, because you couldn't have Israeli and Israeli sub transiting the Suez to get there without Egypt being on board with Israeli action against Iran. And so you have this growing coalition that is willing to act against Iran, led by Israel, and you have the United States, it seems, well, not it seems, but the United States cutting off all support for the Saudis against the Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen, right in this area. And you have the Americans outing the Israelis about the attack against the Iranians to try and paint Israel as the aggressor, or at least as there are two equal sides, a tit-for-tat battle. We've discussed this in the past about that is the game plan for the Biden administration, when really you have an Iranian terrorist organization or regime that is trying to export its radical, fanatical ideology taking over the Middle East, and the Gulf states in Israel and Egypt at this time saying, hold on a minute, this is dangerous. And the United States is trying to play up Iran as just an equal adversary in this war.
So this realignment that's taking place between the United States and Israel, and then this alignment that's taking place between Israel and these Arab states, put this in prophetic context for us, because this really is a pretty dramatic realignment and change in political affiliations going on.
Yeah, it's led by the Americans turning the traditional alliance for the past decade on its head, in favor of the Iranian regime and or other radicals, such as the Sunnis, that are in the Muslim Brotherhood, such. It never used to be that way.
Reinstitution of that Barack Obama policy, that pro-Iranian policy that Joe Biden's boss was so forcibly advocating, and that President Trump so forcibly repudiated.
Right, and it's exactly the same. Yeah, exactly the same. And we've written the latest in the latest Trump print edition. We have an article showing that President Biden's foreign policy here in the Middle East is the same as Barack Obama's: empower Iran, downgrade relationships with their allies, say you're doing it on the behalf of human rights violations, and so we treat our allies differently, we expect more of them, so that's why we're coming down harsh on our allies, and it seems like we're more harsh on our allies. But the truth is, and everybody in the region recognizes this, that America has flip-flopped, and they are supporting Iran. Now, in terms of biblical prophecy, we know that Iran is going to rise to be the dominant power in the Middle East, at least in the Red Sea passageway, at least even including an alliance coming up with Egypt, which might mean the leader of Egypt might fall by the wayside, since he's anti-Iranian right now. That's what the Bible says in Daniel 11 and verse 40 to 43. It details and lists a number of nations that are allied with Iran, and they are these nations that are on the western side of the Red Sea passageway: Ethiopia, Egypt, and then going up into the Mediterranean, Libya. So we know that the Red Sea is a focus. Bible prophecy says the Red Sea is a focus for Iran. Who knew that it was going to be the superpower of the United States that empowered Iran to fulfill this biblical prophecy? I think that's a shift that people weren't expecting. However, if you look back to the 8 years of Barack Obama, and especially the second term, when he pursued vigorously the horribly flawed nuclear deal, which funded the Iranian regime, then it makes sense to see his assistant, Biden, doing exactly the same thing. But now I think the difference is you see them actively playing this narrative against Israel as well. And I think that's what people could expect going forward, more and more coming out against Israel from the United States, as well as the empowerment of the Iranian regime.
Well, Brent has an article in the new Trumpet print edition, Biden Middle East Policy, Pushing the World Toward Christ's Return. Really excellent article giving the overall prophetic context of this foreign policy shift that we're seeing from America. And we will link to that article in the show notes, as well as the first part of a booklet by Gerald Fleury, Germany's Secret Strategy to Destroy Iran. Part one of that booklet talks about how Iran is getting a stranglehold on the Middle East, and it is increasing its presence there in the Red Sea and throughout that area, and putting that strategy that it has in its prophetic context. We will link to that also in the show notes for today's program. Thank you, Brent, and we look forward to hearing more from you down in that area that you're visiting. We appreciate you coming on to give us that report. Is Russia about to attack Ukraine? It certainly is amassing its military forces near this neighboring country and making Ukrainians very nervous. To learn more about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Biden administration announced yesterday that it's considering sending warships into the Black Sea just as a show of support for Ukraine. And that's because, as you said, Russia has been just really building up its military presence along its border there with Ukraine. So this buildup has been underway since late March, and videos have popped up all over social media showing just columns of tanks and armored vehicles making their way to the border, also trains just laden with military hardware of all kinds. There are huge convoys of military trucks. And one video that I saw showed a chain of Russian military helicopters, a chain that just seemed to go on forever, just heading to the border and bringing, you know, soldiers and supplies there. So it does look like quite a lot of firepower that's involved here. And it's actually believed to be the largest military presence that Russia has had there at any time since 2014. And the Ukrainians are understandably worried about all this. It's still a fresh memory, you know, what mm-hmm. happened with Russia invading Ukraine about 7 years ago. Russia invaded and took some of Ukraine's choicest territory there with Crimea. And around that time, Russia also sent covert troops into parts of eastern Ukraine, into Luhansk and Donetsk, to support pro-Russia rebels there. That conflict has been somewhat frozen for several years now, but it's estimated to have killed about 14,000 people so far. So, you know, it's faded from the headlines here in the U.S. for the most part, but it's an ongoing nightmare for many of the people living there. And now, with the Russians building up their forces just across the border, there are many who fear that this could be an invasion that Russia's planning, and that Vladimir Putin may feel like this kind of frozen conflict situation is not adequate anymore, and that he wants to make some of those territories in the eastern part of the country an official part of Russia soon, as he did with Crimea.
Earlier this week on the Trumpet Daily program, Richard Palmer, he did the program on Tuesday, and he was just talking about how many instances there are right now of these great powers being more aggressive after Joe Biden has come into power in America, and they're taking advantage of his weakness in the foreign policy sphere. Is that what's happening here in your view?
I think that could definitely be part of it. You know, we have a new administration in the U.S. For the last 4 years, President Trump maintained a reasonably good relationship with Russia. But Putin also recognized that Trump was someone who would, you know, have the back of U.S. allies and partners such as Ukraine. But now we have Biden in office. And Biden and Putin have already had some pretty serious just verbal altercations with each other. But Biden would also be someone who Putin may calculate would not really do much to protect America's partners. So maybe this could be a bit of a test of the new administration. As I mentioned earlier, the U.S. is mobilizing warships to the area, so we'll see what happens. But then there's also a ceasefire agreement that was negotiated a few years ago between Ukraine's government and the pro-Russian forces in the eastern part of the country. And that ceasefire, it definitely didn't end all of the violence, but it was a big step, and it cooled things down quite a bit. But on on April 1st, that ceasefire expired, and Russia declined to play any part in negotiating a new one. And instead, it's been amassing all these forces at the border there. So that ceasefire could be a part of this as well. There's also the fact that the president of Ukraine has been shutting down a lot of pro-Russian TV stations. And that could be prompting Putin to really up the ante a little bit there. There's also the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is nearing completion. You know, Russia could be trying to exert a little bit of more pressure on Ukraine right now, you know, telling them that they're going to have to pay more for gas because of this new pipeline that's near completion. A lot of factors, but yes, I think the Biden administration being in power there could be a major part of it.
Our editor-in-chief has been warning from for quite some time that this kind of activity is only going to increase under Vladimir Putin's reign in Russia. He's been right several times. Russia has stepped up and done quite a lot to show his expansionist goals. We could very well see something like that here. It's a little bit difficult to say, but this seems very consistent with what Gerald Flory has been saying we can expect from Russia.
Yes, it was back in 2008 with Russia's invasion of the former Soviet nation of Georgia that Mr. Flory said that marked the beginning of what he called a dangerous new era that Vladimir Putin was leading the world into. And we've just had mountains of evidence proving that that was really a turning point, you know, in history, I think, and that Mr. Flory was right about that. And now we have these forces amassing here. So, you know, I think this really could be the start of something significant that would prove once again that Mr. Flory is right about Vladimir Putin's role in end-time events. And I think the fact that the U.S. is talking about sending warships there is interesting and something to keep an eye on. But when you view this through the lens of Bible prophecy, I think the more important region to watch for a response to Russia's aggression is Europe. You know, Europe is the one that we really need to be focused on. Mr. Flory has written and spoken about this several times. Just after Russia annexed Crimea, he wrote an article called "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe." And in that one, he said, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way, and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire." So I think, you know, the Europeans certainly haven't forgotten Russia's acts of aggression on Georgia, on Ukraine, and everything that's still going on there right now. And actually, just yesterday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel demanded that Putin reduce this buildup that's happening along the border there. So we know that Europe is fearful of Russia. And that fear, as Mr. Flory said, is deepening their desire to unify Europe.
We can point you to that article, "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe," from Gerald Flory. We'll link to that in the show notes. We also have an article by Rufaro Manyepa on thetrumpet.com. "Is Russia going after more of Ukraine?" And go check that out. You can see the video of several people taking pictures of what is happening there on the border and those Russian forces pouring into that area and get more prophetic context for this important story. We thank you for that, Jeremiah. Problems are increasing on another border, this America's border with Mexico. Since the Biden administration came to power, migrants have been flooding into America, and one retired official says all this activity is being directed by drug cartels. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, they just released the preliminary data for March, and Border Control agents, it looks like they've apprehended 171,000 migrants at the border during that month. And so that's more than double the number of migrants apprehended in January, the last month President Trump was in the White House, and a record high for the past 20 years. It's been, I think it was March 2001 was the last time they've apprehended that many, and the numbers may still go up. It doesn't look like it's slowing down, so we'll see what the numbers for April and June are. But just like a huge influx of migrants coming into the United States. And like you mentioned, retired U.S. Marshal Robert Almonte is saying that drug cartels control all the activity on the border. This is a quote he said on Fox News this week. He said, it used to be just smuggling drugs, but they're into everything. You have what you call gatekeepers there that control everything. Cartels are heavily involved in human smuggling because they're making a lot of money. They've been doing that for a while, and now you're seeing an increase in their activity here. And then there was also the Hidalgo County Sheriff pointed out that it's pretty typical for the cartels to charge anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500 per person to smuggle migrants into the United States. So you do the math there. That's every that's $1 million in revenue for them every 1,000 migrants they smuggle into the United States. And there was 171,000 migrants came in. I don't know if they paid all of them, but yeah, that is millions and millions of dollars coming in to these cartels, which is concerning not just for the United States but for Mexico, because these cartels, they already control, best estimates are about 20% of the territory in Mexico that are, it's, you look at a map and it looks like it's controlled by the Mexican government, but 20% of the territory is really controlled by these cartels. And now the cartels are running the border as well. That's something that, even the Mexican president, he got on television to address this, and, he's, astute enough to know what the problem was. The Biden administration was trying to blame President Trump for this problem, saying that, well, he cut aid to Central American nations. And you're like, all right, well, if that made a difference, you'd think that he did that a while ago. You'd think that the migrant crisis would have been bad last year, and it wasn't. But the president of Mexico said, he's like, no, these people, they see Biden as the migrant president. His party's the one that's keep talking about how we should be welcoming of migrants. So they're just trying to get to the border as fast as possible.
The danger posed by these cartels to the United States really can't be overstated.
Right. No, not at all. Because, yeah, first of all, I mean, there's just that, like, a huge percentage of homicides in the United States are gang driven, and most a lot of gang violence is drug driven. So, I mean, they've definitely very intricately tied with America's domestic crime problems. And then being able to, like, control the border like a gatekeeper, like that retired marshal was saying, means that those domestic crime and gang violence and drug problems are likely to get much worse. And then there's also the foreign element you've got to be able to consider here too, because like I said, America's enemies, I mean, they know that like if they want to undermine the United States without actually declaring an official war against the U.S. military, the drug trade is really one of the best ways to do that. It's like a proxy war for the United States that you can wage war and cause internal problems in the United States through domestic gang violence rather than sending a foreign military in. And two of the primary players that use that strategy are Iran and China. Or like I said, Iran, one of their chief proxies is Hezbollah, which is very deeply entangled into Latin America, very deeply entangled into the drug cartels. They've got this scheme going where that Hezbollah will usually give like logistic support. They've got experience in guerrilla warfare tactics, so they give the logistic support to the drug cartels in return for a commission of the drug money, which they then through a fairly convoluted path. Sometimes they end up buying used cars to hide the fact that the money came from drugs, and then they'll sell those cars in Africa, and then they'll use that money. But eventually, if you follow the money, this commission they get, it makes its way back to Lebanon, and then they use some of that money for wars against U.S. soldiers in the Middle East. So we've got a domestic war and a foreign war kind of on the same team. China as well, it's getting more and more that the heroin industry is moving away from naturally grown opiates and moving towards like synthetic fentanyl molecules manufactured in Shanghai and in Wuhan and in other places. and that the Chinese are shipping that across the Pacific Ocean to the drug cartels that are then trafficking it into the United States. And the fentanyl, it's quickly becoming the most dangerous drug in America. So it's definitely it's a fact, having a deadly effect in America. But when you look back at some of the writings from like Mao Zedong's time, the communists were a little more open and in your face at that time. They fessed up to the fact that China was doing things like that on purpose, not just to like make money on the black market, but to deliberately undermine the United States by pushing drugs into it. And it's been a while since a Chinese leader has actually admitted that point blank. But when you look at the effect, China, they're famous for being an authoritarian dictatorship that controls the economy. So the fact that they say that, like, oh, well, we can't help it if our private industries sell drugs to Mexico mm-hmm. that go into the United States, is like, well, you can control everything else in your centrally planned economy mm-hmm. Except for this drug trade, which is apparently free enterprises rules all.
Yeah. It's just painful to see this happening to America and what seems to be an administration that is complicit in this really undermining of American sovereignty, introducing so many problems into the United States. And they, as you said, they insist that there's no real crisis here, but what we're seeing is really a curse on this nation.
Right. Yeah, definitely. There's a couple of Bible verses that come to mind about how this is prophesied. The one that you just mentioned, it's like in Deuteronomy 28. It's one of the blessings and cursings chapter. It talks about that if Israel or God's people disobey his laws, that their high and fenced walls will come down and strangers will flood into the land. So it's really talking about an open border, which apparently when Moses told the Israelites that, it was just kind of common sense that, like, oh, if we disobey God, we're going to have an open border, and open borders are bad. Mm-hmm. Today, that statement's a little more controversial, whether an open border is bad or not for some strange reason. But when you look at the crime problems and the drug problems, you see that it is definitely a curse on America. Another verse that we've brought out in an article that's up on our website, drug cartels control America's southern border. We can put that in the show notes, but another verse is in Isaiah 5 and verse 5, where God's making the same point he made through Moses in Deuteronomy 28. But he likens end time Israel or America to a hedged vineyard. A vineyard, so it's like if you have a vineyard and it has a hedge, it's like a fence that it keeps the foxes and other stuff out so they don't eat all the grapes. But it's talking about that God says, I'll tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge and it shall be eaten up, and I will break down the wall and it shall be trodden down. And so that's another verse about like this open border. You break down part of the hedge and then you've got, anyone can just come in and eat up the grapes.
Very sad to see this going on, and we appreciate you bringing that to us, Andrew. We do want to recommend that you check out his article on this subject, Drug Cartels Control America's Southern Border. That is up at thetrumpet.com right now, and we'll link to it in the show notes for this program. Over now to England, where the royal family lost a patriarch today. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, died. Buckingham Palace released an announcement just a few hours ago about it. The announcement states, "It is with deep sorrow that Her Majesty the Queen has announced the death of her beloved husband, His Royal Highness the Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh. His Royal Highness passed away peacefully this morning at Windsor Castle. The royal family joins with people around the world in mourning his loss." And Prince Philip was 99 years old. He and the Queen have been married for over 70 years. He's been a real support to her for a long time. And he's been struggling in recent years with his health. He stepped back from public engagements in May 2017. He was admitted to hospital in mid-February. I guess he was treated there for some kind of infection and a pre-existing heart condition. He was discharged on May 16th, so just a few weeks ago. But on their 50th wedding anniversary, the Queen said that that her husband, Prince Philip, had been my strength and stay all these years. And she said, I and his whole family and this and many other countries owe him a debt greater than he would ever claim or we shall ever know. So, like I said, a big blow to the Queen, to the royal family, and to Britain, really.
Not exactly unexpected, but still another blow to the Queen amid a whole lot of turmoil with the royal family lately.
Right. And she's certainly going to miss that strength and stay as she goes through potentially one of the worst crises, at least in terms of the royal family, of her reign. And I it would be a real blow not having him there to lean on. I mean, we've got this time period now where Prince Harry and Meghan just a few weeks ago basically accused the royal family of racism and institutional racism. And you already see the effect that accusation is having. You're seeing the royal family lose a lot of support in the United States, losing a lot of support among ethnic minorities in the UK, a lot of popularity with the younger generation in the UK as well. So that's definitely having an impact. And it's also just the latest in a lot of tragedies for the royal family. I mean, it kind of feels like each year, at the end of the year, people coming out and saying, whoa, that was like a really bad year for the royal family. We saw it in 2019, where there were a series of pieces of bad news that kind of culminated in Prince Andrew giving his infamous interview about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. That caused just a massive scandal for the royal family. You got right into the 2020, and then you had, you know, quote unquote, Mexit with the Sussexes claiming that they'd been so mistreated by the royal family and by staff working for the royal family that they pretty much had no choice but to flee the country. And these kind of attacks. Well, there's kind of been, I guess, a steady drip of news from then since then, which then we had a massive torrent of that with their Oprah interview. So it is a very hard time for the Queen to be without that help.
Anytime this is happening in light of what we have been learning, our editor-in-chief has been talking about the throne of David and what's been happening to that throne. It's important to view this in the context of that bigger picture. Can you just explain about that?
Yes, it is important to understand that, I mean, really all of this has been forecast. You know, Mr. Flurry, I was on the front cover of our September 2017 Trumpet print edition. We had an article from the editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, The Fall of the British Royal Family. And in that article, he said that he wrote, what is wrong with Britain and the royal family? This article is more important than people generally realize. And then shortly after that, we had his book come out, The New Throne of David. And he talked about how there would be a sharp decline in America and Judah and a rapid decline in Britain's royal family. So he's writing in 2018 that we're going to see a rapid decline in Britain's royal family. And that's exactly what we have seen. I mean, like you said, it's not entirely unexpected for Prince Philip, who's 99 years old, to die like this. But it certainly comes at a bad time, and it is certainly after a series of pieces of bad news. So, you know, when Mr. Flurry talks about there being a rapid decline, I think events have shown that he was absolutely right about that, and there's something here that we really need to pay attention to. And he was basing that forecast on what the Bible says and on Bible prophecy. And so he laid out those prophecies to a certain extent in that article, The Fall of the British Royal Family, but mostly in his book, The New Throne of David. He goes into exactly what the Bible does tell us about this throne, about this family, how significant it is, not just for Britain, but for America and the whole world, really. There's some very significant events that the Bible talks about revolving around this throne. And that book is worth paying attention to because we have seen it proved right time and time again in just the 2 or 3 years since he wrote that. And this sad piece of news is more evidence of that.
A All right. Well, thank you very much for that. Richard has written an article about Prince Philip and his death today. You can see that at thetrumpet.com. And we'll also link to that article from Gerald Fleury, The Fall of the British Royal Family, as well as his book, The New Throne of David. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. And we appreciate that. Richard, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, the Biden administration renewing formal aid to the Palestinians, China single-handedly undoing efforts to combat climate change through shuttering coal plants, big tech companies selling out to China, and more. We'll be right back after this break.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We spoke in the first half about the Biden administration's foreign policy shift away from Israel. There's yet more evidence of that shift this week. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, this week the United States decided that it was going to refund the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA. This is the agency that supports the Palestinian refugees. And if you're confused about that term, it refers to the Palestinians that fled Israel at the start of the 1948 War of Independence, when Arab states attacked Israel and lots of them left. And Israel said, since you were fighting for the opposition, this is very much simplifying it, but we are not allowing you back in the country. Now there's 6 million, apparently, refugees that are stationed in mainly Jordan, Lebanon, some in Syria, and also some inside the West Bank. And as part of this group, this UN-backed, UN-organized group, they also organize a lot of the education for the Palestinians. And while that does sound great, some of the things that they are educating the Palestinians on is incitement against the Jewish state and Jews themselves. And so President Trump and Mike Pompeo decided that it was a horrible use of United States funds to fund an organization that promotes anti-Semitism against the state of Israel. And if they decide to change their educational model and the textbooks that they use, then they would look back and decide to refund them, perhaps. And it turns out that the Biden administration is foregoing all that, and they have just donated $150 million towards this organization. This is what Erdan, who is the Mr. Erdan, who is the ambassador to the United States, that he said about this decision. UNRWA's incitement activities and the fictitious way in which it defines who is a Palestinian refugee only perpetuates the conflict and encourages hatred among the Palestinian public. And then he expressed his regret to the United States State Department about this decision. And so really this decision, it does highlight the fact that the Biden administration is not expecting the Palestinians to change in any way to receive United States taxpayers funding once again. And this is the small... easy, I would say, UN agency to fund. The next one would be the Palestinian Authority itself. But we definitely see a move by the Biden administration here to disregard what Trump did with the Israelis and put back in the forefront the Palestinian problem, because that does create a mess for Israel in terms of its public face of public opinion in the public opinion in the world. And so, again, just another one of these big changes cannot be seen as a pro-Israeli move by the Biden administration.
Remarkable, considering the progress that the Trump administration made in improving relations between the Arabs and Israelis, that they would just go take such a hard turn back to a policy that was failed over a period of decades. But we'll refer you back to that article that Brent has in the new print edition of The Trumpet, Biden Middle East Policy Pushing the World Toward Christ's Return, if you want more information about that this policy turn by the Biden administration. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Efforts to combat climate change have closed a record number of coal plants in America and other countries, but not every country has been participating in this coal reduction effort. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, a new report was published this week by the Global Energy Monitor. And at first, it looks like good news for people who are concerned about global pollution. This report focuses on coal plants, and it says that 2020 was a year of record reductions in closing coal plants in the U.S. and the European Union. In the U.S., there was a reduction that equaled 11.3 gigawatts of power. And then in Europe, it was about 10 gigawatts of power. So just enormous reductions there as those economies transition toward cleaner energy. But all of that reduction and all the reduction from other nations was offset by massive increases from China. So when it comes to new coal plants that were started up last year, China was actually responsible for 85% of the global total. So just a staggering number there. And it shows that even as China tries to look like it's becoming, you know, a responsible global leader and a nation that others should look to for leadership, it's actually playing by an entirely different set of rules. It views itself as the exception to everything, and it behaves in a way that is entirely self-serving. So I haven't heard many environmental activists in the Western world calling attention to this report, but you can be sure that if it were the United States that was offsetting progress by other nations, then we'd be hearing quite a lot about that. But since it's China, all the experts seem to just, you know, give it a pass. So that's a really ridiculous double standard there.
Well, we see a lot of double standards these days in a lot of different areas. But yeah, the relations that many of these countries have with China, they seem to be really oblivious to a whole lot of concerning issues regarding this country. There are other arenas where it's problematic, but just in the issue of pollution, China has a whole lot on its record.
Yes, China is a terribly polluted place. You know, right now, most of us are used to seeing people wearing masks because of COVID-19. But I was pretty surprised during a visit to Beijing back in 2018 to see so many people walking around wearing masks. And that was not for germ control, but because of pollution. You know, they were just trying to protect their lungs from prolonged exposure to this terribly polluted air there. A recent report actually shows that 265 of China's 338 major cities all have dangerous levels of air pollution. And there are about 1.5 million people there that die of it every single year. That's mostly from ground level ozone and fine respirable particulate. The data also shows that 16 of the world's 20 most polluted cities are in China. And you know, China was a latecomer to industrialization. They didn't even really begin to industrialize until the mid-1950s. And the Chinese use that as an excuse right now. They say, you know, you guys in Europe and the U.S., you used to pollute a lot more when you were industrializing, so now it's our turn. But really, it's just a lousy excuse because they have Western history to look to. They have better options available that the West didn't have at the time. And they could accomplish everything in ways that are far less destructive, far less myopic, if they were willing to be even slightly less greedy and self-serving.
So you mentioned this double standard, and this is happening right amid all of the effort to combat climate change, all of the consternation about how much we have to reduce carbon emissions and so on. And the United States says it's committed to this, and yet it allows this to go on. This is actually something that Gerald Fleury has pointed to for quite some time as being exposing the real agenda behind that climate change movement.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. He's written quite a lot specifically about the Paris Climate Agreement. That was a big environmental accord that U.S. President Barack Obama joined during his last year as president, 2016. And President Obama bypassed Congress to do it because he knew that Congress wouldn't pass it because it's, you know, a terrible deal for the U.S. and not even much of a positive for the global environment. So he joined it by executive order. But then the very next year, Donald Trump became U.S. president, and he pulled America out of that deal. He understood that it was costing the U.S. these astronomical sums of money and that nations like China were not obligated by it to do much of anything. So, you know, ultimately it was very asymmetrical and not actually beneficial for the planet's environment. So President Trump pulled out of it, and Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury really defended that decision. It was in our August 2017 issue that he wrote, The agreement obliged America to pay $100 billion a year for actions on climate change. And who would the money go to? The United Nations. Does anyone really believe the UN would have wisely used that money to protect the environment? It may be the most corrupt institution in the world. And then a little further down, he says, when America joins an agreement like this, it immediately begins paying and keeping all the regulations. Not so with other nations. China, which is the greatest polluter in the world, only agreed to achieve the peaking of carbon dioxide emissions around 2030, which means its emissions could keep increasing for the next 13 years. What's happening here is not about the environment, it's about destroying the United States. The regulations this accord binds America to abide by, and the funding it obligates America to provide, accomplish that purpose very nicely. So I think that's just some very sound analysis. And now here we are a few years on, and President Biden has put the U.S. back in the Paris Climate Agreement. And now we see this report about China just expanding its coal usage so much that it actually offsets the reductions by the U.S. and every other country. So it's easy to see that this agreement is something that empowers China. China abuses it and ignores it while it does pretty much everything it can to surge ahead of the U.S. And I think if anyone would like to understand more about that, we can leave a link in the show notes to Mr. Fleury's article that I read a bit from there. It's called What the Paris Climate Agreement Was Really About.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah. China's growing use of coal is, as I mentioned, it's hardly the only concerning issue surrounding this ascendant power. Yet many businesses in America, including supposedly woke big tech companies, have no problems doing a whole lot of business with China. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, one of the senators of the United States that's doing a ton of business with China is Silicon Valley. Although billionaire tech investor Peter Thiel slammed these Silicon Valley leaders this week for outsourcing vital technologies to the Chinese Communist Party. On Tuesday, he participated in a seminar on China along with former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Then at the seminar, Thiel accused the big tech industry in the United States of being useful idiots for the Chinese Communist Party, specifically regarding their agreements to transfer a new and innovative American technologies to Chinese companies that are using American-invented artificial intelligence and facial recognition technology to oversee the genocide of the Uyghur Muslims in Western China. But here's what Peter Thiel, he had to say. He said, "It's some combination of wishful thinking. It's useful idiots, you know. It's a Chinese Communist Party fifth column of collaborators. I think if you think of it ideologically or in terms of human rights or something like that, I'm tempted to say it's just profoundly racist. It's like saying that because people look different, they're not white people, they don't have the same rights. It's something super wrong." And when he's talking about racism there, that's just his analysis of the fact that Americans, they're seem very concerned about human rights in America, but have no concern for the Uyghur Muslims. Mm-hmm. And though others might more accurately say that than America's doing that, maybe not so much because of racism, but more because of profit. And Peter Thiel himself mentioned later in his interview about how companies like Google, they're working on artificial intelligence with communist China, but they won't work on it with the U.S. military or the Pentagon. And just wanted that there's really a crazy double standard there where that they're giving all the things that they won't even work in some of these technologies with the U.S. military, but they'll give them to the Chinese Communist Party due to the fact that they're either ideologically aligned with the Communist Party, probably in some cases, both of them believing in socialism, or in other cases, just the fact that China is this huge 1.3 billion people market, and they want to get in good with the Chinese Communist Party so that they can sell apps and other internet technologies to those people and make a ton of money.
Right. Yeah, Richard wrote this article about why the wealthy are woke in our most recent print edition. And you look into the details of this and how these companies are willing to basically they are so aggressive in advertising all of their virtues when it comes to the United States, but then they just completely shove all of that aside so that they don't jeopardize this very lucrative market with China trading and doing business with them and getting parts from them, manufacturing, using Chinese labor, and you know, every aspect that is required to do business, and overlooking all of these very concerning issues. Richard's article is excellent in that new trumpet. We'll definitely link to that. But he talks about even prophetic implications with the way that they're prioritizing these economic concerns over all principle and all morals and all ethics.
Right. Yeah. In the book of Amos, particularly chapter 6, the prophet Amos, he had a lot to say about wealthy elites in ancient Israel oppressing the people. And with some of these business deals that they said that they're really not grieved for the affliction of their own nation, and are even oppressing many of their own people in return for like money and profits with trade relations with nations like Egypt and Assyria back then. But you do see the same mindset today with what Lee Smith at the Tablet talks about, America's China class. It's like this class of politicians and business leaders and tech moguls and media big shots who kind of rule the country almost like a pseudo aristocracy, but they've sold out their own national interest to China and other nations in return for power and for money. It's like some of the details Jeremiah was bringing out earlier, like to the closing down American fossil fuel industries, but helping China build up their fossil fuel industry. Or I think Peter Thiel, I saw another report that I didn't bring with me about like even some of the slave labor that they're using in manufacturing like solar panels in China.
Right.
So you're looking at that. They're like, okay, well, we're woke, we're green energy, but you're almost as bad as or worse than some of the slave owners in America 150 years ago that you like to complain about so much. Well, you're doing the same thing in a foreign nation today.
Well, I would encourage you to read Richard's article in the new Trumpet print edition, Why Are the Wealthy Woke? And we'll also point you to our cover story to our February 2021 Trumpet edition, Wake Up to the Threat from China, for more information about this subject. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. One final story. Violence has erupted again in Northern Ireland. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, more than 70 police officers have been hurt. Police are calling it Northern Ireland's worst violence for years. The police used water cannon for the first time in 6 years after they came under attack. There's a picture of a bus being set on fire that has kind of captured the attention of the media over here. This rioting has largely been by loyalist youth, people who want the Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom. They've been throwing bricks, fireworks, petrol bombs at police and vehicles. There have been sectarian clashes between Protestants and Catholics, Catholics generally wanting a united Ireland, Protestants wanting to remain part of the UK. And I think really what is at the core of this is loyalists have kind of got the message, violence works. And if you want to get what you want, if you want to get your way in Northern Ireland, you have to break the law and you have to engage in violence. And that is how you'll get your own way. This is the message, I think, that's been sent by the UK as a whole, by the international community. You know, Sinn Féin, the IRA terrorist group, have been appeased for years. You had the 1998 Good Friday Agreement and the way that implemented, that gave them so many of the things that they wanted. At the time, the Trumpet called it a most shameful capitulation to the forces of terrorism. And so it's not too surprising that loyalist forces are kind of engaging now in the same kind of behavior. The final straw was a prominent IRA terrorist died, and Sinn Féin held a big funeral for him with about 2,000 people. So loyalist events, loyalist parades, they've all been cancelled and outlawed by COVID regulations. But Sinn Féin could have this flagrant breach of COVID law, and nobody was punished at all. So this double standard caused a lot of anger, again, not just about this specific event, but has been welling up for the past 22 or 23 years that helped trigger this violence. You've also got Brexit playing a role here, where these loyalist forces are absolutely against a border being drawn within the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and the UK as the Brexit agreement puts in place. And then also there are criminal elements involved in these gangs. It is very hard to get a true picture of what is happening in Ireland without talking to people on the ground. People, even journalists in some of these areas, still live in fear to some of these IRA groups and militant groups. So I don't think we necessarily have a full picture of what is going on. But certainly, this type of violence, and that Britain and America would see rioting and violence, is something specifically forecast in the Bible. You can read our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that talks about how the decline of the United Kingdom, the decline of the United States is prophesied. And you see trouble in Britain, with Scotland wanting independence, Wales, they announced a manifesto, the Plaid Cymru Party wanting Welsh independence. You see trouble in Northern Ireland again. So all of these different cursings were exactly forecast in the Bible, and that book explains why and how.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Richard. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Horace Mann. If a man seeks for greatness, let him forget greatness and ask for truth, and he will find both. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.